Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 267. Very exciting episode. Very exciting episode. I'm not going to just keep saying it's exciting. I'm actually going to play the episode in a sec. But first, a couple of things to plug. Wait, don't fast forward, scrub ahead. Listen, please? Okay, thanks. Nerdist channel, youtube.com/Nerdist. New series, Blood and Guts from Fangoria and Scott Ian. It's a makeup effects show. Super kick-ass show. The first episode was Greg Nicotero. We're also going to be having a lot of Walking Dead-themed programming at the Nerdist channel around the premiere of Walking Dead, October 14th. All weekend long, Walking Dead-themed programming. And Talking Dead returns right after Walking Dead on AMC, October 14th. That's my show, in case you don't. Well, I probably talk about it enough. Enough about me, but here's some more about me. I'm going to be performing at Zany's in Nashville December 6th through the 9th. So if you go to, just look for Zany's. You probably know how the internet works with your Google or your Alta Vista or your Lycos or however, or your web crawler, however you search things. And then there's going to be a lot more stand-up shows because my Comedy Central special premieres November 10th. And once that airs, it's new hour of comedy time. So I'm going to go on the road and we're going to work that out together. It'll be more fun than it sounds. It's not going to be shitty. So that's all that business. I would like to thank Stamps.com for supporting this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. You can print and buy official U.S. postage using your own computer and printer, or someone else's. I guess if you know, it doesn't have to be yours. I mean, now we're just getting into semantics. The fact is, you can print any U.S. postage, mail any package, any letter. Postman will come pick it up from your house. You never even have to go into the post office and just build up that disgruntled rage that slowly boils until it just spews out like hot magma at other people in your life. All that goes away. Right now, if you go to stamps.com, you can use the promo code Nerdist for a special offer. No risk trial, $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and up to $55 of free postage. You're welcome. Go to stamps.com before you do anything else. Click the microphone at the top of the page and type in Nerdist. That's stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist. Okay, you guys. Oh, man. I'm almost hyperventilating even introducing this episode. So, it's Tom Hanks. And if you read the thing that was downloaded, you might be like, bullshit. But it is not bullshit. It is serious. It's funny. But, I mean, we're serious about the fact that it's Tom Hanks. And you gotta say his name, Tom Hanks. He has one of those names you have to say his first and last name. I'm told I have the same thing. It's me, Chris Hardwick. Yes, even I do it. So, this was a superlatively fun episode. Tom Hanks was gracious and as nice as you've heard he is. Super hilarious. I'm really proud of this episode. You know, after working on this show for a couple of years, almost 3 years, and then someone like Tom Hanks says, hey, I want to do your podcast. It just validates us in a way. I'm getting gushy now, damn it. Yeah, I better put my cynical pants back on. Oh, cynical pants bursting! I love you, Tom Hanks. And I love you, Nerdist Podcast listener. Thanks for letting me ramble a bit at the top. I'm just overexcited. That's what nerds do. Okay, Nerdist Podcast number 267 with Tom Hanks!
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Where do I sit?
We'll sit right here.
Okay. All right. Let me get a soft thing for my cup of tea.
Oh, gosh.
So it won't bonk. Does anybody need anything?
Maybe we should put soft things under our glasses.
Well, let me get you some soft things.
I'd rather a coaster.
Just a cat.
Paper towels.
I'm going to go into do not disturb mode, which I
did you really?
Thoroughly
that's
appreciate.
Great, right?
What it
did
only
you do?
Took
what
six
you
iterations oh, yeah. of the firmware, too.
Oh, is that right?
Between that and
oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, it's just you don't, you can still,
what is
you can
a,
still
what's
get
it. What's it like to produce a baseball game? Is it great, or did you go nuts after a while?
I did it 8 years. I did every, I traveled with the team. So
oh, that's fun.
I used to love baseball, and now.
What happened? What did baseball do?
Now you've seen behind the curtain.
Not so much.
Yeah, and all the magic's gone once you see that. It's all fake, like wrestling.
I love the idea that baseball would be all fair.
I was for a couple games with the Dodgers. I was the guy on MLB.com when I first moved to LA that would track the pitch and be like, oh, it was a 78 mile an hour curveball.
Really?
The break of the pitch and where it landed. See, that was a. That was.
Does your attention ever wane? And so you're not like, you don't pay attention for like three pitches?
You would occasionally, I would look up and see, okay, that was a fastball.
Do you ever fall asleep because you're watching baseball?
No, Jonah, I love baseball.
See, and I don't know enough about sports because you said when I track the ball, and I'm like, where else does it go other than that direct line?
I was saying the other day, you remember the Dodgers used to have the guy in the hat behind home plate that would lift up the radar gun, and then he'd pitch, and he'd put the radar gun down, and he'd write something down on a pad, then he'd pick the radar gun up and up again.
Yep.
But it was only for the Dodgers pitchers. Right?
Yeah,
or was he only the visitors? I can't remember.
Well, it depends because there's either scouts there for either team that'll have their own radar guns.
Right. Because
they don't trust the radar.
Oh, right, gun. Right, yeah.
And then there's the MLB guy.
Well, I felt bad because he probably got put out of work because of some gaffer's tape. You know, they just taped the radar gun, you know, to the backstop, and that pretty much provided them with all the information.
This tape is taking our jobs.
I like to think that when they look at the pad, it's just full of pages that says, I'll get you someday, I'll get you all.
And flipping.
We got it.
That's all important records that end up making it possible for them to rig the game.
Yeah, exactly.
As you yourself have just noted.
What do you do with these? Why, store them away and put them in a warehouse? What happens?
I don't know.
That's not mine.
That's what the signals are between the catcher and the pitcher, reminding him of how slow or bad he has to throw the ball so that the gamblers will win the. I don't watch a lot of sports, but like ESPN, but evidently there was a big. I didn't see the game, but there's a big
play. Oh, there was
play.
Something with a football.
There was
game.
A football thing last night in which either the refs got it completely wrong or.
They did.
Did they get it completely wrong?
Incredibly so. Last play of the game. What was clearly not a touchdown. There's a picture of it too, because one ref's got his hands up, other ref's going no, and this is also off of the Sunday night game where the Patriots lost off of a field goal that clearly was not.
You already
goal.
Lost me.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
too
I'm
bad. But
so
my
think the,
my point until I was put to sleep there for.
I'll do it to anybody.
Was that they said on TV that something like worldwide like $500 million. Was lost because they didn't beat the. I don't know how point spreads work or anything, but because they scored a touchdown and didn't beat the spread or beat the spread, whatever it is, a lot of people lost a lot of money.
Yeah. And that guy just walked off the field and said, "I'll just be."
Yeah, I'll.
Well, it's like that guy that with a Cubs fan that caught the ball and made it.
Oh,
all
that
run.
Guy! Yeah, that, did they make
Steve
a documentary?
Bartman, a 30 for 30 on ESPN.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
it was great.
So beware.
Yeah.
That's you know. I'm not going
to games. Just don't go to a game.
You could do something so stupid or natural that will haunt you for the rest of your life.
It's like going to a foreign country and then you just you end up like scratching your head. You're like, they don't do that in public.
Well,
here.
I think I don't know. And again, I don't know much about sports, but someone made fun of me on Twitter because they're like, there's a sports thing happening right now that's huge and you probably don't know about it. And I didn't, so I called my mom, who's a huge sports nerd.
Okay. Yeah.
And she laughed at me for not knowing, and then she explained, well, all the refs are on strike, and they brought in all these temp guys, and there was... So it essentially sounds like they just, like, pulled in a guy who worked at Foot Locker because he had the shirt on.
Yeah.
And then that was the
And this will be, in 20 years, this will be an Adam Sandler movie. I can count on that.
Replacement ref.
Yeah.
It's a wacky, feel-good comedy.
It's him, Rob Schneider,
Kevin James.
Somehow Al Pacino still
alive. I'll tell you what the story is right now. A lowly insurance salesman, or even worse, like a dental hygienist, You know, his wife doesn't respect him, his kids don't care about him, or he can't find love. You mm-hmm, pick.
Sure. Yep.
Whatever the modern dilemma is. But lo and behold, he gets hired to be the replacement ref for an NFL game. And goes on for, I don't know, either getting it wrong
or wrong. Well, Tom, I'm curious. Yeah. At the end, would he redeem himself in some way?
Oh, I believe what would happen is the kids would have newfound respect for their dad. Because he stood up for his principles.
It's right. Really, it's a...
Because he was the only one who saw what really happened.
Right. And then, well, then there would have to be some sort of proof to justify his existence.
Well, what's going
to
happen is there's going to be a rabid, kooky fan in the stands
Steve Buscemi, who happened to have
the only iPhone right where it was supposed to be. There was actually a Brady Bunch episode about this in which Greg was the team photographer, and he actually kept blowing up a picture to find out that, yes, the guy did step out of bounds based on his. So believe me, we've worked it out. And by the way, all movies are essentially based on old Brady Bunch episodes.
So there's that
one
where.
I can run you through some of mine. And
well, I'm pitching You Can't Play Ball in the House. Mom said not to play ball in the house.
Yeah. That was Apollo 13.
Oh, was that it?
That's right.
Boys, put that down.
The difference is, put down that litter module. The difference is, when we make these jokes, nothing ever happens. But if you say replacement refs, someone would ask. Yeah.
I'm telling you right now, I'm late to the game.
That's on the poster.
I'm late for the game. Oh, that's so brilliant.
You can't help it.
But somebody has already pitched it, copyrighted it. I believe it's already in development at Fox.
All I want is for the Hollywood Reporter to say, Nerdist Podcast proves Tom Hanks to star in Replacement Rest. And you've actually just committed yourself.
Hey, well, you know what? That could spread like wildfire. That'd become a viral thing. That's right.
I've determined that you are the spirit animal of this podcast, because if you look at the Venn diagram of the three of us, you fall perfectly in the center in the shaded region. Matt is obsessed with NASA. Jonah is obsessed with music. I am obsessed with, I'm probably going to hit you up about comedy talking.
Yeah.
So you are the perfect center for this podcast.
Oh my God, this is like my wife's worst nightmare, to talk about this stuff all day long. I'm reading in bed and she leaves over there and says, what are you reading now? But honey, it's this theoretical possibility of mining helium-3 from the moon. And she says, are you insane? Can you not read a book? Can you not read a novel? I read this stuff for pleasure. What can I tell you?
You need to hide your space books in a porn magazine. No, honey, I'm reading pornography.
No, honey, this is just an old penthouse from 1977.
Whoa, they really get in there.
Liftoff.
So I want to kind of talk.
But you're wearing the NASA. You got the NASA polo.
Yeah, I got this at
which is really good.
Johnson Space Center.
Now you know what that logo is called in NASA ease.
I actually don't.
Okay, there was two warring NASA logos. Like all companies that make a really bad decision, they decided, hey, let's update our logo sometime, I'm going to say, in the 80s or the 70s where nothing good ever happened.
Sure.
And and it just said NASA in like gold letters, right? Which was called the Worm because the letters were sort of connected. So around NASA, they called that the Worm, but they call that the classic Eisenhower-era NASA thing with the circle and the... And the Delta, which is the red part of it, they call that the meatball. These are the things we found in our research that went on for years and years for the many space projects actually involved in. As a matter of fact, it was the title for the second episode of From the Earth to the Moon, The Worm and the Meatball.
See, you could have done that.
We could have done it. That was a series I was promoting. It's not just about space. It's about the people who work at NASA. And we have one that's about the whole public affairs office. It's going to be fascinating.
But while we're talking about
they're
going to have to make pasta in space.
They might have. I'm sure they freeze, you know, I'm sure you can probably eat that on this space station. What do we have tonight? It's worms and meatball night.
Or beef stroganoff. It's the only two pieces.
In a bag you have to cut open with some scissors.
Yeah. Did they ever give you the option of, hey, do you want to go up to the space station?
No. That was before. I mean, every person in the press said, "Would you go into space?" Sure, but no, they didn't offer that kind of stuff. That's actually when they, lo and behold, they were wasting time sending scientists and engineers into space.
When are they going to go?
As opposed to smart-aleckly celebrities, they didn't let us go.
Actors and football players. That's all.
But then that one guy, Dennis Tito. went. You know, he was the first bona fide tourist in space.
Yeah.
And with the name Denis Tito, it sounds like he's a Russian astronaut from 1963. But he went up, and then after that, they were all going to say, tourism in space is right around the corner. But I don't know. I know that Richard Branson is going to try to.
That's barely space, though.
Well, I agree, yeah. And they'll okay. Now I hope a million. I hope he makes $1 billion.
Yeah, sure.
You know, because he needs more.
Exactly.
But I think you're just going to go up. It's like a suborbital flight. Yeah. You'll go up. You'll experience weightlessness.
It's like being in a U2, I assume.
Well, it's kind of like being on a really fast merry-go. I mean, you go up and then you come down, yeah. And when you say experience weightlessness, you're not going to unbuckle your thing and float around the cabin, because the cabin is about the size of, you know, a Mazda Miata. Yeah. You'll stay buckled. This is my understanding. You'll stay buckled in. You get to look out a window, and I guarantee that unless you take a massive amount of preparatory medication, you will then vomit your guts out. You will just be so, so sick.
Yeah.
Because it's having been in something much like that, if you don't take the medication, you get really, really sick.
Did you learn that the hard way?
I did. But I also learned about 50% of everybody who goes into space spends about 24 hours incredibly nauseous. As in, I can't move my head. I have to keep my eyes closed. Nauseous. And that's 50%, regardless of how flight experienced you are. So anytime they go, I always say, how busy is that first day?
Yeah, it's the same.
What do you got to do? Oh, we have the busiest day of this all is the first day. Yeah. We got to release this and put this together and figure out how to do this. Well, half that crew is, you know, can you give me a minute, Skip? can you just give me a minute here? I'm right there. I've got the checklist. I'm right there. Just give me a second.
I'm going to blow some space chunks all over this capsule.
Hey, by the way, hey, hurry up. Let's get this done because it's meatballs and balls and worms.
Ooh, lovely laundries.
Turn on the first night.
Can the first day just be a pajama day? Can we just
Can today's first meal be some soda crackers?
I just want to watch some Netflix.
Let's just watch the earth go
straight
on dark.
The couch.
Give me a second here.
I got to work with years ago, like I think around 98, I worked with a director named Joel Zwick.
Mm.
Who you worked with.
Joel Zwick directed the pilot for Bosom Buddies. Then he went off, The Traitor, and directed the first season of a show, I think it was called It's a Living, Making a Living, and Jillian. And a few other people. Yeah, the waitresses in the Bonaventure Hotel downtown. He went off to do that, and we worked with a bunch of different directors, and then he came back and directed the entire second season of Bosom Buddies.
Yes.
Joel Zwick, yeah. And he directed... My Big Fat Greek Wedding, too, the movie.
Oh, he directed the movie?
Yeah, he directed the movie.
I mean, hilarious guy.
We needed a shooter. We need a shooter. Get Joel Zwick. He'll shoot it.
Sweet guy. Last time I saw him, he had like a mullet and these like hairy ape arms.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the crew was afraid. He was very sweet, but if you crossed him, he'd be like, I'm going to come up to that fucking control room. And like he would kind of have these moments. And then everyone's like, whoa. But...
Now, I'll tell you something about Joel. He started directing at La Mama, off Broadway. If you know theater of the world, La Mama is like the cradle of off Broadway, you know, late 1950s, early 1960s, you know, interpretive dance and poems in which, you know, plays that are just one guy just screams the same line over and over again while other people dance and pretend to be rivers. I mean, that's the type of plays that he did there. And so he went from there. He went from there to Laverne and Shirley. perfect trade.
That explains Lenny and Squiggy. That actually explains.
Well, you know, he was. I'm telling you, he's a shooter. Joel is bald, by the way.
Oh, he is now.
Yes, okay. And I always say, Joel, why don't you wear a cap to hide the fact that you're bald? Because then people would know I'm bald. I said, okay, this is interesting. That's true. When I've been out at Arts Deli and stuff like that. The guys who wear their ball caps indoors are all bald.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You kind of put
there's a certain amount of understanding.
Yeah, but only Joel can get there with that reasoning.
But I made him regale me.
What did you do with him?
I did a sitcom in like 98.
What was that?
I was called guys like us on the UPN network, which I'm sure, you know, which is thriving now.
Jeez. I remember the UPN network.
Yeah, it was.
I kept trying to get them to come to my house and deliver packages.
Well, you don't know.
They never did. It was so weird.
I'm not convinced.
What was it called?
It was called Guys Like Us. It was just a simple, like, we did one season. I'm still not convinced that UPN wasn't a memory implant.
And no, UPN had two logos.
They did.
Did it?
The worm and the...
and the mountain. The mountain and the... What was it? Why was it called UPN?
United Paramount Network.
The United Paramount Network.
Yeah, that's strange. Yeah, and then they went away and kind of became the CW with the Warner with the WB network.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
There was some shifting.
When everyone went, Fox did it. Let's do it too.
Yeah, they were trying to.
Yeah. How hard is it? True. Oh, it's hard.
All you got to do is slap some shows on the air. What was it called?
It's called Guys Like Us.
And you did an entire season.
We did a season.
Like, how many episodes?
We did 13.
Oh, okay. All
right.
We did
13, but Joel worked on the show.
So they didn't pick up the back nine.
We did not get the back nine.
As they used to say. When I was at TV, it was all of it. Are we
going to get the back nine?
Are we going to get the back nine? Jeez, are we going to get the back... Ah, we got the call for the back nine.
Yes! No, the UPN was really interesting because they decided to do this 5 nights a week of primetime programming, and within 6 months had completely backtracked on all of it. You're like, well, got to stick with something. They kept Malcolm and Eddie.
But what channel was it on in L.A.?
13.
Okay.
Dreaded channel. Same channel as Star Trek Voyager.
Right? Yes, it was.
Okay,
that was the
anchor
of the UPN.
And one of the 10 o'clock news shows it is on.
But I made Joel Zwick regale me with tales of Bosom Buddies because I watched Bosom Buddies first run.
Oh, my God. How old were you when Bosom Buddies was on?
Maybe like 10 or 11.
Okay, yeah. I think I was, when was it? I was 25, maybe? 25, 26, yeah.
Holy shit. And when I was in college, Scolari taught me how to juggle.
Oh, okay.
And so...
Yeah, he taught me how to juggle, too.
He loves the juggling.
He still does it, yeah.
But Joel said, you know, we were talking about you and the show, and he said, Tom always had a theory. And his theory about films was this. He said, you get one chance. You get three chances. If the first one hits... Then you get three more chances. Like, there was this weird algorithm of movies, and he told me the whole story about Splash.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I was like a kid, like, taking notes, like, uh-huh, go back to the last part. And then what was the thing about...
Oh, it's true, yeah. Joel was right. I haven't talked to him for a while, I have to admit, but we would check in every now and again on, you know, status of the business. So, yeah, we would talk about that. I was probably mouthing something that... You know, some agent something or told me like that. Yeah, but there was that was back when everybody made. There were a million movies about guys who can't get laid. Remember that that era of motion pictures? And there were a ton of us who made all these movies. The guy who can't get laid,
right.
And they were all set. They were set in a ski resort, or a fish market, whatever it was. As a guy who can't get laid. And the CIA, even back then, they're just all these like kind of like relatively modestly budgeted comedy. Yeah, so we would talk about trying to figure out to maintain our place in the food chain of Hollywood. So yeah, Joel would keep up with me throughout those early days because you know what happened to me was we got fired, and I sat around for a year thinking. Oh man, I used to be one of the Bosom Buddies. And Joel was off directing, you know, whatever the next thing came down the pike. What did he direct right after?
Wish I was on It's a Living.
I think they then changed the title to Making a Living. Believe it or not, they did that. It was called It's a Living when it started. I swear to God, this is true.
This is equal to the
worm and the meatball. They started off called It's a Living, and then the executives at ABC said, we need to really boost this show. I know. Let's change the title to Making a Living.
Oh, that's a good. That's so good.
Just they're good geniuses. Note, good they were all geniuses even back then. Yeah. But Joel, we had adventures with Joel, man. That was a wild time when we did it on the lot at Paramount. We were like the ugly stepchild of all the shows that were on because Taxi was there. And Happy Days was in its 90th year, and Laverne and Shirley was still like Laverne and Shirley could show their empty living room of Laverne and Shirley's apartment and finish number 7 in the top 10.
That's all they needed,
and a Boo Boo Kitty, and that you were right there.
Boo Boo Kitty,
and Mork and Mindy. Was right across the street from us, and we were on stage 25, the stage of death, where every show that had been on stage 25 had been canceled after six, never got the back nine, disappeared after a season. Wow. And we made it too, so we sort of like broke the hex. And then right after us, as a matter of fact, I think like the last week we were shooting there, Jim Burrows and the team from, I don't know, maybe from Taxi, whatever, were coming over. They were looking at the stage 25, because they then built the Cheers set there, and that was a stage that Cheers ran on for the 42 years of its existence. Yep. So were it not for Bosom Buddies, me and Peter Scolari breaking the hex of stage 25.
You guys did it.
Ted Danson would not be on.
Kelsey Grammer, where would you be?
I don't think anyone would argue that Cheers was built directly on the back of Bosom Buddies.
Well, this is what I'm taking to my grave. They saw our cheesy little squared-off coffee shop. And so let's blow out these walls and make the biggest bar in the history of the world.
See, you're too nice. A person in your position should call Jim Burrows and go, Jim, it's time. Listen, I think it's clear that you owe me a lot of money.
Well, here's how sad I was. I actually would watch Cheers live with a misty-eyed sense of nostalgia.
Oh,
that's stage 25.
That's where we put on the dresses. Well,
I know where that is. The stairs leading up to stage right lead up to the dressing room.
The size of Cheers is even funnier when you go to the real Cheers in Boston, because it's an old pub from like the 1700s.
It's about, what, 700
square feet? The ceiling is about 5.5 feet.
You know, yeah. TV is, I don't want to bring this to you, but TV is all fake.
No, Tom.
But movies are still real, guys.
Yeah. Movies are like, we go to the real places and shoot real things.
Remember that time you turned from a kid into a grown-up?
Yeah, that was real. That was real. Okay, I'll tell you, this is like a surreal moment in life, okay? Big had come out, and there was the Academy Awards that year, and I was backstage waiting to be told to do something, and I swear to God, Federico Fellini was sitting across the couch from me. Federico Fellini and I are in the same room. I have never felt more like a stupid doof in my life, because I don't know what to say. And thank God a lot of people were moving around, because I never would have known. And Federico Fellini says to me, he leans over and he says to me, "You got big." Oh my God. Meaning I was a kid, but I got big. So I was, oh my, holy smokes, man. That was a high country there.
Hey,
that was a high country.
Satyricon, right?
That's right. Yeah. Hey, how about that 8.5? You know what you should do? You should do 10.5.
You're welcome.
How about you and I do 10.5? You know what I'm saying?
Fellini.
You add two?
Bosom Buddies. You want to do the feature film?
Crazy, man.
But it is interesting to see, you know, you did kind of make that. Not a lot of TV people were crossing over into film at that time, because it was still I think the businesses were very compartmentalized. It was like, you're either TV.
Yeah, there was that. Yeah, and that's not the case anymore. Good work now just begets good work. But I tried to get a couple of other jobs that just didn't pan out. So, I mean, I got, you know, I signed a couple of contracts and tried to develop, you know, TV shows, and none of them were any good. So I was like unemployed for a couple of years. The only jobs I had was, I actually did an episode of Happy Days, in which I was the only guy to I kicked the Fonz through the plate glass window at Arnold's,
you bastard.
Which evidently, and everybody,
bucket,
you know,
list.
You know, you're the first guy to hit the Fonz.
Am I really? Yeah.
Wow, great!
And back.
And then I did. I did Family Ties.
Yeah. Oh.
They called me up and said, "Hey, would you like to do this?" And they, you know, it was like an offer, which never happened. It's like, "You want to come on and do some Family Ties?" Oh, geez, yeah, sure.
You'd make a good drunk, Tom. Come on.
So I went on and I was Michael J. Fox's Uncle Ned and Tina Yeather's Uncle Ned.
I think that's how we'll always remember.
And then I did another one the following year, and Ronnie Howard yelled at me for going back, because we had by that time we had done Splash. And he said, come here, I want to talk to you. We were at something. Now, I hear that you're going back, you're going to do it. Now, you can't do it. You can't do it. You know, you got it. He was trying to protect his movie, and I was like, dude, they called up. I did it. I said, what's the deal? It's just, you got to declare. You got to declare yourself. You got to say, no, I make it feel. So, but I needed the gig and needed the money. So, but back then, yeah, it's true. There was a kind of a separation, but I was no longer working in TV, so officially I was just an actor.
Yeah, therefore, those, I rated. But those movies where you had like really great TV writers, like going, you know, like you had Splash, and then also movies like Night Shift, which really like those comedies were so, and then ended up, you know, like really kind of defining the early '80s comedies.
They really did. Well, look, I will probably credit. I mean, the whole era was sort of framed because. Like, I'm gonna.
Babalu Mandel?
No, well, Babalu Mandel and Lowell Gans. But when Bill Murray went off and did movies like Stripes and whatnot, it made a certain type of comedy like really box office-y. I mean, think about it. Prior to that, what were comedies? It was all like, you know, Neil Simon's California Suite and stuff like that. So when Saturday Night Live, people from Saturday Night Live went off and made successful comedies, and I'd probably give, you know, it's probably Bill Murray was a granddad of all that stuff. Stripes and a few of Meatballs, you know, yep, get back on the theme of tonight's podcast,
which is
Meatballs. then all the studios just got in. Actually, Animal House was another, of course, that was the most profitable and successful comedy of all time. Yeah. So then all of a sudden just became part of the what is it, the economic business model of Hollywood. Let's get a bunch of cheap comedies out there, relatively cheap comedies. And, you know, some of them stuck.
But when you're, you know, it is the sort of the path that you ended up ultimately going down. Is any of that in the plan or in your mind?
Oh, hell no. Oh, my God. I was like, just understand, you know. You ever get up at night and it's like pitch dark and all you know is your throat is on fire and you got to get a glass of water, mm-hmm. and you don't turn on any lights, and so you just stumble, you just jump out of bed and you run as fast as you can, mm-hmm. into the bath. That's what my career was. It was a dark house. I was stubbing my toe left and right, but I had to get some water because my throat was on fire. That was it. I never know. I just, you know, took it for a while there. I took every job that came down the pike. You know, just, you know, I was a racehorse, a thirsty, desperate racehorse.
What were some of the movies that you would have not taken if you were in desperate?
What do you mean? I'm sorry.
Like, are there any movies where you're like, oh, if I wasn't like just looking for the next gig, I probably would have passed on it or anything like that?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, that's you know, that requires too much wisdom, which. It was a wild, fabulous time. It was a great ride. I will admit, I probably did not get tired. I mean, literally, like physically beat until. Right after I made this movie with John Patrick Shanley called Joe Versus a Volcano, with my first movie with Meg Ryan, which was a fabulous experience every step of the way, and is a bodacious movie for a big percentage of it. Actually, I stole a line from it. John Patrick Shanley wrote this line for Lloyd Bridges, who I had a long scene with, and Lloyd Bridges is like, and man, when you're doing that. But man, you're in the high country. So I think I just said that earlier in this podcast. So I still use it. But when that movie was over, I had probably made, I think maybe 12 movies almost back to back, and I was exhausted.
Yeah.
And I kind of like I probably went down for as long as I can, and then you just pick them a little bit. Yeah. Actually, the movies became much more involving. You know, they were. They took longer to do, and by that time I probably felt as though I had a bit of a better understanding of just what my
process was.
You know, the research that you had to do and the work that you had to do in conjunction with everybody.
So that's about 10 years in.
I had a run there, man, where I made a ton of movies, and my joke is, and two of them were pretty good.
Maybe three of them
were pretty good.
But because I'm always interested in the idea of like how long it takes a performer, whether it's a, you know, comedian or a writer or an actor or whatever, to go from that place where you're like a young, hungry kid to sort of like, okay, I know who I am now, and I see, I have a better view of
it. Man, for me, it was just totally age-based, you know, because it all started when I was in my 20s, and, by the time I was about 31, 32, I'll tell you this, okay, I know this for a fact, because my 27th birthday was celebrated in the Bahamas on the final day of shooting for Splash. So they quickly rigged the wrap cake, you know, that celebrates the end of shooting. They took like a tube of toothpaste and wrote Happy Birthday, Tom, on the same cake. So that was my 27th birthday. So from 27 to about 32, maybe 33, man, I went berserk. Yeah. Like every day was a doubleheader.
But Splash was a hit, and Bachelor Party was a hit. And
Bachelor Party was a hit.
But Big was like, oh, that's a whole other kind. I mean, that movie was in the theater for like 2.5 months.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, played it a long. Yeah, that was probably it. And I think that was my 9th movie.
Wow.
Big was. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
9. And I think Joe versus Volcano was my 12 to 13. So I continued the quote-unquote hot streak there of doing anything.
Well,
is there catering? Am I going to wear a costume? When does it start? Tuesday? I'm there. Let's go.
But I'm, you know, because even so, you know, again, just the way that the industry kind of compartmentalizes people and puts them in boxes, you know, it's pretty much, it's all comedies at that point, and a lot of kind of slapsticky comedies. So how do you go from... Where's the turning point between that and like, okay, Philadelphia?
I got very lucky because Penny Marshall, who directed Big, and it landed, you know, it kind of like landed because it fell out of financing a couple of times. And when it came back around to me, Penny was hell-bent on the theme of what the movie was. So she was saying, she had faith that I could get there along with her. So it wasn't just about jokes. I started off in classical repertory theater, so I always wanted to play Iago and stuff like that. I did, you know, very straight Shakespearean tragedies and stuff like that. But what had sold for me was the things that I had learned with Joel Zwick on Bosom Buddies, which is this thing is thrown on your desk on Monday morning, and you got to sell every one of those friggin' jokes and that thing. You got a scar. I got a scar. so that's what I did. And by the time I got to work with Penny on that, and also prior to that with Sally Field, and David Seltzer's Punchline. It was not a matter of scoring anymore. We were now dealing with, you know, more serious themes. I must say my 5th movie, I only remember the order of the early ones, because once you get into double digits, I don't know what number the movie was. But my 5th movie was Nothing in Common with Gary Marshall.
Yes.
And that was, that, you know, they had themes about fathers and sons and stuff like that.
Jackie Gleason.
So I had by that time a taste and experience of aiming beyond just selling the thing. I worked with really talented people from Second City who were the staff in the advertising agency. You get to this point where you're now part of the filmmaking process. Not every director says, come on and let's talk about what we're going to do. It. By that point, Penny was saying, you know, you're going to have to love her, you know. She's not some fake girl. She's not a fig. You're going to have to love a little burger.
I'm sorry, Penny, I didn't get that last part.
I didn't either. I'm just literally imitating the sounds I heard.
That's right. We're all just standing here.
Penny just wrote a book, by the way. It was something called Suddenly My Mother Was Nuts or something like that. Penny just wrote a book.
Yeah, the font really small.
It just trails off.
Yeah. But here's what you should do. Eat it with some crackers in your mouth. Come over here. I'm comfortable. I'm cognizant. I just said I went and did The Odd Couple with Jack Klug. And I'm playing secretary. Actually, I played his secretary. That's the way.
I have a Penny Marshall translator app.
I'll hold it up.
It's like Shazam.
You know what's interesting? Penny Marshall, frontwards and backwards, says the same thing. Because when she's like, I'm going to try to shoot out my plan. And he did the backwards, right? It sounds exactly the same. that's the way it sounds.
You heard the Penny Marshall.
I want to try to shoot in Rye Playland. That's what she said.
I podcasted Larry King yesterday, and I was on his set, and there was a glass in front of me with lipstick on it. And I was like, what was this? And he was like, ah, that was Penny Marshall. She was, I just had her. And I was like, oh my God, if I drink from this, it's almost like I'm making out with Penny Marshall. That's a story.
That's a story right there.
Why wouldn't I?
And also something about the hygiene around the new Larry King.
Had to let that kid that cleared the glasses.
I just like to think that it's like...
I'm just saying disposable cups, maybe?
I like to think that Penny just lives in the walls. Like, oh, it's Penny again. She's put her mouth on something.
She hasn't been here for years, but the lipstick shows up on the glass every Tuesday.
Yeah, I said Penny is... I love... She reclaimed me a couple of times. I mean, Big was really a... I mean, I got the nomination for that, and it was huge. And it made the big deal about that. It made $100 million over the course of the entire summer. It squeaked.
Wow.
It opened in June. You remember this kind of stuff. It opened in June on the incredible sum of like 800 screens, which at the time was like, that's insane! 800 screens. Now movies open up on 35,000 screens.
Yeah.
And it opened in June, and it just kept doing business so that by the time... We actually, the first time I ever went to Venice for the Venice Film Festival in Venice, Italy, which is, you know, a big deal for, you know, a kid from Oakland, California, we had a cake that said, congratulations, $100 million. It was a big deal for a movie to make $100 million then.
People give you a lot of cakes.
But we had, I know, and it was a tasty cake. And we had it on what I call the Hitler Terrace of Venice, you know.
Oh, right. So,
when you go off to film festivals, you always stay in hotels where Hitler went, you know. And he stood right here on this terrace. And so we had a cake that said $100 million on it, but we were still only at like 97.8 million.
Oh.
So they were fudging the numbers even back
with actual fudge.
With delicious Italian chocolate fudge cake.
What do you think Josh Baskin ended up being like as a grown-up?
Okay, let's play fan fiction.
Let's play fan fiction. And then we'll put him in sexy situations.
Well, let's see, how old... I believe he grew up to be a very poorly respected dental hygienist. His kids don't care for him. And lo and behold, what happens to him is the NFL replacements are called for. He tried to bond with his kid by refereeing the local football.
You're making jokes, but this
football.
Is brilliant. This kind
it's
of a
fabulous
weird
idea,
sequel.
Man. It's a good idea. But I'm telling you, Fox already has it in development. I'm telling you right now.
I like the idea that whole experience actually screwed up the rest of his life because he always thought, no, don't always be a kid. But then at a certain point, it's like, you kind of got to be a crook.
Okay, so here's something interesting. Years ago, when Bob Zemeckis and I were shooting Castaway in Memphis, we contacted, or maybe he called, Michael Connor Humphreys. You know that name, Michael Connor Humphreys? Michael Connor Humphreys played young Forrest, the little Forrest Gump.
Oh, yeah.
The little kid where he's running and the braces fall off. And so we hadn't seen him since we had made the movie. And in your mind's eye, he's still essentially a seven-year-old kid. And in walked this gorgeous bohunk of a guy who was now out of high school. And we had a really nice, like, 40-minute conversation where the three of us just sat. You know, it was for him, it was a huge experience off to make that movie for all of us. And so we had a very nice kind of, like, go-around. We didn't talk about the movie much. We talked about how we were doing that. He was a really great guy. And without absolutely no sheen of, you know, a lot of stuff can go awry with a kid actor who's in a movie.
Sure.
But he had a great life, and he was very happy, and he was going off. And then, just last week, I was at this thing with a bunch of veterans, and I came across a guy with a 101st Airborne patch on his shoulder. I said, oh, hey, 101st, puking buzzard, screaming eagle, the whole bit. So we share something, and he says, hey, I got to tell you, I was Michael Humphrey's commanding officer. He was in the 101st Airborne and was in Afghanistan.
Oh,
and he's, I believe he's back now. And he's
doing good.
So how's that for a perspective on life that goes beyond anything like that? That was pretty impressive.
Well, that must be especially because of the types of projects that you produce and are involved in. It must give you a nice perspective. I'm like, oh yeah, all the pretend acting stuff we do is really not the most important things in the world. When you're looking at NASA and war,
people truly risk their lives and do things. Yeah, yeah.
But do you feel like that kind of deep dive is something that's sort of, because you seem like a very grounded, just like, you know, I mean, there are all the legendary stories of like Tom Hanks is the nicest guy you could ever meet, but There must be some sort
Shakes
of a...
No? Never heard
of you bet. Except for the people I fired. Ask them. No. Well, the job... Look, I have to say, the job is so fun, and every time I go off and see something that blows me away, all I am is an audience member. That's all, you know. Some new thing that's like on TV. Like, I was so happy for Damian Lewis. He just won.
Yeah, for Homeland.
Damian Lewis played Richard Winters in Band of Brothers. He was like the star of Band of mm-hmm. Brothers. And we had every future British star was in Band of Brothers.
True. Yes.
I can literally go off and name them. And I've come across some guys like Jude Law. I said, Jude, why weren't you in Band of Brothers?
You wouldn't hire me in Band of Brothers.
I didn't get past the audience. Oh, sorry about that. I wasn't responsible for all the casting. But you know, you can never discount how important the bond is between the audience and the project. I mean, people see this and they really do invest the same brand of heart and what have you, that you, if you're lucky enough, we get to as the folks who make them. So it's a business. It's work to be taken very seriously in a business that is just worthy of skewering every chance you get. It's just the goofiest business on the planet. It's high school with ashtrays.
I mean,
not as many ashtrays.
Yeah, yeah.
I know, that's what we used to call junior college. I went to junior college for 2 years. Chabot Junior College. I said, hey, how's college going? It's high school with ashtrays. That's all it is. You had to smoke in class, and people did, you know. Had professors who would smoke in class back then.
College is great.
My friend was in 13th grade.
Very true. Yeah. Very true.
Do you ever, you know, when you're kind of getting to a point where it's like, you know, big hit after big hit, and you know, it's Philadelphia and Forrest Gump, and you're just knocking them out of the park. Do you have that artist thing of superstitious at all? Of like, does it kind of screw with your head, or how do you kind of maintain your balance?
Honestly, it takes a while because you think, you know, you think you're gonna for a while there, you're MC Hammer.
Can't touch this.
And then you know, next summer, you're MC Hammer. You know,
you're just Hammer.
God bless that guy, without a doubt. You know, that's what the vagaries are, and you have to be prepared for it. And so the work has to be the quality of the work you do has to be the most important, because nothing will ever sustain. And you will pour yourself into stuff that ends up not doing anything, and you'll pour yourself into stuff that does okay. Like I did a movie, Larry Crown, which came out a few years ago, and man, worked, loved every day working on it, worked really hard, blah, blah, blah. It came out, did absolutely no business whatsoever. But that doesn't diminish what I think was the power of it and the connection that we had to it. And I got to tell you, I get letters almost every day regarding almost every movie I've ever made. Going back to, Dear Mr. Hanks, I was laid up the other day and I watched some of Turner and Hooch.
you talk to Hooch.
I don't. I'm sure Hooch is dead by now, but and I'm not one to cry in movies, but when I saw that, I got to say, it reminded me and my dog that I had, you know, and they all react to things. And Larry Crown, even a movie like Larry Crown, I get letters right now that say, Dear Mr. Hanks. I had some reversals of fortune lately. and I was feeling very down. I was depressed, but I decided to do much. Then I saw your film, and I signed up for classes at the local college, and I met a very nice girl. And right now, I have a very nice job working in the food service industry. And so you hear this kind
also,
of stuff.
Also, George Takei is my
man. It's like vox populi. It's like, you know, the people speak over the long haul. But the people that go berserk is everybody that you know that represents you and works for you. You know, they think that. They think that that gravy train is just going to keep on running, and eventually you come up and you just do a movie and everybody says, okay. So here's the other thing that is very interesting. I was working in Europe almost all last year, just by happenstance, and there's a huge difference between this is a big difference between people who walk up to you in Europe and people who walk up to you in the United States, and even the press. In the United States, all they want to talk about is the hits. You know, they will still talk to me about, so did you know in making Toy Story, or Forrest Gump this, or blah, blah, blah. When you go over to Europe, they mention the most obscure films you have ever made. Mr. Hanks, your film, Terminal, this was me. I was the story of Terminal.
Oh, you were trapped in an
you
airport?
Make, you make my story. You make my story. And they will mention, like, the stuff that, you know, it never really saw the light of day.
Oh, Mr. Heinz, I must tell you that here in Germany, we very much appreciate your film Bonfire of the Vanities. We found it to be a very funny look at the greed of an...
So you have no idea how things
I really
are
thought
play.
The Germans were going to be into the Burbs.
Well, you, I'm going to tell you, you get those. I was at... my wife and I were on our... Actually, we were on our honeymoon, and we were driving from... this first time we went, we rented a car. We were in Europe. We drove from Paris, France... She drove out of Paris, by the way, because I wasn't about to tackle that. Yeah. Yeah, you ever see that? You have that roundabout around the Arc de Triomphe? My wife navigated that. And I was petrified every step of the way, but she wanted to go over to this dress designer's place. And so anyway, so we drove, and we were in Italy, and we stopped at, all the food in Italy is great. So you stop at the Otto Route. And they have, like, their version of a Howard Johnson's is actually like a 4-star Italian restaurant.
Right.
Everything is homemade. It's all fantastic. It's
handmade
great.
Nut logs.
And so we're in there somewhere between Milan and Rome, and I'm getting up the greatest lasagna and stuff. And it happens to be the Puerto Rican national baseball team is touring Italy for some reason. And I'm pouring some stuff. And hey there, Tom Hanks, you're so funny in Bachelor Party, man. That's my favorite movie. We see this on the bus, the Bachelor Party, you're so funny. Yeah, so I'm doing it like Bachelor Party, okay, fine. Nothing ever dies. Nothing ever dies.
And they hold
nothing
up the mixer, like they do the
thing. Yeah, they do the whole thing. Oh my God.
They come up crying. There is
they love it. When that donkey died, that's so funny.
I mean, of all people in the world. You know, like, a lot of people have, like, one project that people, like, shout lines from, but you have so many movies that people can just be like...
I've made few sequels. That's the only thing.
They shout. I mean, it must be like a nonstop. They quote the movie, and you're like,
Okay, this is no lie. This happened just on Sunday night. I happened to watch... Or Monday night. When did the Packers play the Seahawks?
Last night.
Okay, last night. My wife and I were going, and we're having people over, so I just had a little bit of the game beginning, and I got such a ridiculous, stupid, silly thrill out of this moment. I never should have. I should be beyond this. I'm 56 years old, for God's sake. But they did a pan of the screaming Seattle Seahawks fans, and they're all wearing goofy football helmets and stuff like that. And I see a dude with a fake wig, a big beard, dressed in rags, holding a Wilson volleyball. And I was upstairs. I said, baby, honey, oh, you missed it. I was so excited that some dude went to a Seattle Seahawks football game dressed up as Chuck Nolan from Castaway. I said, what does this have to do with beating the Packers? I do not understand, but my hat is off that guy. He made my night.
He feels like his team is trapped on an island.
Maybe that's it. That's right.
There could have been a lot more Chuck Nolans after he got off the island. You wouldn't know.
You never know. But what that dude was doing with it, it's like seeing your name in the paper. He's like, hey, look, oh,
that guy couldn't have dreamed. I mean, his ultimate dream would be, I hope Tom Hanks sees this.
Well, there's no way you can go on YouTube and like enter in Packers, Seahawks, Stans, Wilson volleyball. You won't be able to find it anywhere. But if somebody taped the game, you know, post it on YouTube, so I can have it and show my granddaughter. See, your dad used to be big. See, he used to be my. Your grandpa used to be a big guy. See, there's a guy dressed up as one of his characters at a Seattle Seahawks
Daddy, that's
football
a homeless
game.
Man.
No. That's based on intellectual property that me and Bob Zemeckis.
You could take a homeless volleyball player on Venice Beach.
You could take her to Disneyland and go to the Toy Story ride, but instead you
no. That's just some big goofy cowboy, you know, that doesn't really speak. No, I gotta show her that. Yeah, I gotta show her how it entered into the national consciousness. Yeah.
Look at these flowcharts. Look at the spreadsheet.
Did you know what zeitgeist means?
That's me. That's me.
Did you ever do stand up before? Or did you did?
No, it, no, I had
so
no.
So when you did Punchline,
no, I didn't have the courage to do stand up. I only did it armed with the celebrity of getting ready to do Punchline.
Punchline is one of those movies that I mean, just from being a comic for some it still resonates with me, and I still go back to those because I think it had some of those moments that sort of every comic fears, where you're having a meltdown on stage and it's like and your dad's in the audience and he's disappointed in you and you're bombing, like just those moments.
Ever happened?
No, well, yes.
Something like that?
Yes, it did. As a matter of fact, it did. When I first started doing stand-up. Oh, you found it!
Oh, yeah! You found it! It is there! That
the Wilson meme.
It
has begun in Seattle.
Oh my God! Now this was on TV for probably 1.8 seconds that I happen to see. Now that dude right there thrilled me to no end.
Now,
Look at him.
Okay, here's my guess, just kind of being internet-y. It says that this is a meme in Seattle, so I think what's happening is a lot of people are actually doing this and trying to be photographed. That it's actually a meme. Wilson meme.
There it is. At the beginning of the Monday Night Football match between Green Bay Packers and Seattle, a shot of the crowd reveal a new meme that we're really, really, really hoping doesn't catch on. Did you not? Who said Zeitgeist? I believe it was you.
Let's call this guy Bill Hanstock. Bill, it's Tom Hanks.
You see, their quarterback for the Seahawks is named Russell Wilson, right, because it's the same surname as the beloved volleyball from that film. Sure can. All right, who wrote this?
That's Bill Hanstock.
SB Nation.
Bill Hanstock.
Curse you, Bill Hanstock. I hope this takes over the world.
There's another kind of meme thing that's happening with you, too, is the putting the period next to the T on a garbage.
Oh, yeah,
the
yeah.
T Hanks. And then also Hanksy, which is the...
The artist. Yeah, yeah,
the Banksy parodies.
The anonymous street gorilla artist, gorilla street artist, as I like to say.
Have you seen any of those, the Hanksy?
I've not seen the Hanksys.
They're great. They're like Banksy, but they're all like always something more pop culture and dealing with Tom.
You seem pretty digital. You're on the Twitter. It's up to you.
I tweet like once every 10 days.
But when you do, gold.
Well, I'm not gonna tweet like just chilling with a cup of tea. I'm not gonna tweet that.
Bob Zemeckis just ate all the chips. Man, that's so like him.
You know what I love? Wheat thins and Philadelphia cream cheese. I don't tweet that. Although that's a pretty good snack. So I wait in order to have something.
Yeah.
Try to do it.
How do you get comfortable with everything? I mean, like, it just, I have this idea that when people fail more than they're used to or they succeed more than they're used to, they kind of get anxious, like, you know, like,
I was really, 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 really fortunate because the TV show was Bosom Buddies. This was a complete also-ran of a TV show, although... I think we had sometimes we had an 18 share, a 22 share.
Wow.
Which if you had now, we would be as big as American Idol, for God's sake. But we were on opposite Magnum PI, Tom Selleck. So Peter and I are on TV, right? We have this TV show. Magnum PI has not even premiered yet. And Tom Selleck is on the cover of TV Guide, which is like, this guy's not even on the show yet. And then, of course, he came on and he absolutely creamed us. So I was very lucky because I was working in, like, quote-unquote big-time show business, but nothing, you know, I'd get recognized every now and again at the, you know, baggage carousel, you know, at the Burbank Airport. And it was only a matter of, you know, kept working for a long time, and every time something happened, it was always... There's always a bigger story attached, like with Splash, you know, the movie was such a huge success, and Daryl was so gorgeous. It was all about Daryl, really. I was a guy in the movie. And Bachelor Party was just like, it was like a ripoff of their successful, you know, get him laid comedy. So that was poo-pooed. So I did not have an overnight thrusting into a public eye. I never had anybody, no studio or network just said, we're going to build a whole campaign around you. And that never happened. It just sort of like gradually went on. And so I never had to, luckily, deal with something that is really incredibly unhealthy, which is the, you know, an immediate attention of the white hot.
That's all our culture is about now.
That's exactly right. Okay. All right. So I drive past a preschool in our neighborhood. And lately I've been driving past, and there, I swear to God, there are 22 paparazzi guys, and they all look the same. They all look like thugs. They're all in shorts, and they all have those big sports lenses, and they're hanging out in front of something like, you know, the Crazy Clown Day School, trying to get a picture of somebody who's just dropping off their kid, which I think is kind of criminal. I mean, it puts the kid at danger and isn't healthy for anybody. But yeah, now it's the coin of the realm. But it's not as expensive a coin as it used to be. It's a volume business.
Oh, wait.
It's a volume business.
You'd be a good person to ask me. How
How is the paparazzi thing okay? Like those pictures, like the footage that they got of Kate Middleton. How is that? Like if I just took a camera and stood outside someone's window and started taking pictures, I would get arrested. How is it okay if those people are famous?
I don't think I'm allowed to say because I'm a celebrity, but I think they should. I think it is criminal. I think it's ridiculous.
It's kind of a weird.
It's okay, a freedom of the press thing, I kind of get it, but I don't see how the pretty girl who's on the new show about, you know, vampires and cops taking her daughter off to get news. I don't see how that's news. And yet, it's to me, it's this far away from really what's the word I'm looking for? There's a malevolence to it. I think it's like a malevolent kind of stalking.
Well, I think there's money to be made. But there's an interesting kind of I've noticed what I feel like they do is, you know, they take people who are really famous who would never do a reality show, and they create print reality shows out of these people, like entire, like just these narratives to their lives, which probably isn't true, just because people crave so much of that.
Well, now people kind of dig it too. It's like now it's like a badge of honor to do byplay with like TMZ or something.
Yeah.
It's real, so weird. Real badge of honor.
It's so weird though. You'll see someone that they're on a reality show because they're not famous. They're just this normal person that has an extraordinary life, maybe. And then they make a series about them that's just their life that is a little bit, you know, constructed, maybe. Then they go on a talk show to say, "Oh, this new season's really good. The new season of your life."
We do some really exciting things this year.
I had a birthday again.
I had a disagreement with my mom. You wait till you see that scene.
It's making all these people think that's the way.
You gotta believe that producers say, "Okay, ladies, everybody's lip gloss in place. Your hair looks beautiful."
Of course they do.
All right, we want you to go to this restaurant and please don't get along. Just go to this restaurant and bring up stuff about each other
that pisses
each other's off. Come up with
something. No one wants
to
see that. Yeah. Please, I'm falling asleep over here. Well, I think, what I really saw happen just in the span of, you know, since reality television's been popular since like 91 when The Real World came around.
Is
people really weren't accustomed to having cameras filming their everyday life, so they acted normally.
Yeah, they are.
And then the producers created, just having known a bunch of people who worked on The Real World, they would always watch the first episode and go, "That's not how that happened. You married something that happened months later and put a voiceover that was never about that." And the producer said, "We never said this was real. It's a reality-based soap opera." And so they're creating characters all in post, and then a whole generation of kids watches that and goes,
"Situations."
Oh, the ridiculous. Like, they took the most ridiculous moments, but then kids go, "Oh, I have to be ridiculous to be on television." And then they do it on purpose.
Okay, all right. You're absolutely right. But that being said, there are three fabulous reality TV shows that I watch as regularly as I can.
Do tell.
Number one, Deadliest Catch.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Now, there's
not
a man in the world who doesn't feel like the biggest pussy on the planet when he watches Deadliest Catch. Because I'm telling you right now, by and large, I see anything on TV, I think I could do that, I could kick a field goal like that. I could do that. There's no way I could survive on one of those boats out pulling that stuff out. I would be weeping. I'd have a hook through my hand. I would have bonked my head
on
something.
Your face, eating your eye.
I'd be the greenhorn that they can't get off the boat.
I just hate wet socks.
There you go.
I just hate
wet and cold and sleepy all friggin' day for like, there's only 11 days in the crabby season.
You're on the boat.
Boom,
just
boom, boom. Couldn't do that show.
I like seafood, so I wouldn't have fun.
No. Mythbusters.
Amazing.
I adore Mythbusters because it's actual science and physics proven. And I must say, the guilty pleasure I have is Storage Wars.
I
love Storage Wars.
I never watched Storage Wars.
You just made fun of me for it.
I did make fun of you for it. Yet 2 days ago on Sunday, I have a couple hours off. I go to turn the Xbox on and Storage Wars is on.
Hypnotic.
And then I stop and I'm not going anywhere. And before I know it, I'm like, oh my God, how are they going to get rid of those skates? Those skates have got to be worth, like, if he doesn't make $400, his wife's going to get in the business.
That is an original horsehair motorcycle jacket from the 1950s. That is going to be easy $800.
This is exactly.
And then the guy takes an old keyboard to Marty and Elaine at
Dresden's
library. He's at the fucking Dresden's room.
I was done. Yeah. They got, what is it? He had the funny guy. had
Barry.
A, had a, huh?
Barry.
Barry oh, had this guy. Great guitar, and he took it, and it's like he's, oh, here's the guitarist from The Clash who's gonna, yeah. I can't remember who the band member was, but he said, no, this is a great
Aerosmith,
guitar.
Aerosmith,
was it?
That's it. Yeah, it was from Aerosmith.
That's it.
Yeah, it
oh, this is a good guitar. This guitar's yeah, yeah. about worth about $4,500.
When he found the drum set, he took it to Stu Copeland.
All the storage guys are hanging out.
And then Brandy and Jared, they got some place down in Orange County. I swear to God, I'm going to punch that into the GPS one day.
Yeah, no, I've thought about it, too.
I got to go off and buy some stuff, man.
I just like watching the kind of the scenes they create, because I, in my head, just I go, oh, that must have taken like 5 takes, but the guy gives the keyboard to Marty and Elaine. And of course, Marty and Elaine are at the point in their lives where they literally lack the ability to emote.
Yes.
Anyway, and so he's like, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do, and he smacks his hand on the keyboard. This keyboard is now yours, and they're like, oh,
that's really. And then I like the setup cutaway. Setup cutaway. As soon as I went up, I knew that was my locker. You know, Dave's gonna pull his shenanigans with me, but I got news for him, buddy. You're toast.
I love that. Oh, gee.
Tom Hanks just did a Daryl impression.
My wife comes home and says, "What are we doing in your office?" I'm like, "Baby, Storage Wars Marathon. I had like 9 of them on my DVR."
You can't not watch it. You can't. Not
oh,
watch
it's
it.
Fabulous.
And then
do you not want to go to that? Look, I'm doing
absolutely.
Pretty good. I could probably get any of those lockers out.
You probably.
So there's something.
Will you please?
There's something about it. I just like to be in the back, you know, and however high it goes. All right, 800 going once. 800 going. $1,000,
dude. You have to go bigger. We have to sneak you into the bag of Storage Wars. They're like $650, $675. $1,000,000.
That's a little bit much.
A bunch of trash bags.
Although, you know, if there's like an old rusty bike in the back of that and some busted typewriters.
Just typewriters.
I gotta tell you, I know those jokers are trying to take this away from me, but I'm telling you right now, that typewriter is mine.
And it just says Tom Hanks on the bottom. And actually, they put your name on there.
Don't forget to pay the lady.
We should do a Storage Wars parody. That would be so
oh
much fun.
Oh my God, oh my
I'm
God.
I'm sure we could get A&E to let us do that.
I'm sure.
I've turned a few people on to Storage Wars, man.
And now
I've
been telling people.
By the way, isn't it great?
Fun of me.
Look at America. America is such a obese and diverse and rich country that people will put stuff in storage and essentially forget about it.
Yeah, forever. Yeah.
And by the way, gold coins.
Yep, sure.
You know, right. Safes with stuff in it, old masterpieces, classic vintage
even
guitars.
Even the white trashiest of people live like kings.
Yeah. There was one. There was in the back behind a mattress, covered with some paint, under a rag, was something that I think Dave Hester said, that could be a Hammond B3 organ. If that's if that's a Hammond B3, that's worth a lot of money. And then it cut to him. Then I tell you right now, I don't know much about music, but if that's a Hammond B3 organ, this locker is mine. Please, I love it.
Dana Gould has that great joke where he's like, one day they're just gonna like lift open the thing and be, oh, there's a desk. What's behind it? It's a bucket of hands. It's a bucket of hands.
That's right. It's gonna be the Silence of the Lambs.
It's a shrunken head. Yeah. Oh, hey, guess what? There's a dead dog carcass back here. Son of a gun. But I'm telling you right now. Brandy and Jared, married forever. That is the greatest marriage I have ever
seen.
They're
a lot of fun.
They are a blast.
They're on Twitter.
I love them when they fight. I love them when they make up. That is a great...
She's going to give me the business. Like, it's so much of that.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, if he doesn't figure out how to get these...
I love when you get little glimpses into how they met. Like, they met at a strip club. That's like how they met.
No.
She was working.
I like to think she was living in a storage bin, and he opened it, and then they met.
Did you see the one where they found a thing that was, like, they thought maybe was a Knott's Berry Farm memorabilia?
Yeah, so they go to Knott's Berry Farm with
their kids. With their kids.
Yes.
And so they turn out it's a worthless thing. It's a repro. But then it shows him riding their rides without the bear farm with their kids. I said,
Oh, man.
Honey, how come we can't be like Jared and Brandy? We haven't even been to Knott's Berry Farm with our
we
kids.
We need to get into some kind of wars.
See, which is what the point of reality TV is all about.
It is.
Teach us how to appreciate our lives.
No, because you people can't see this, Tom actually removed
his glasses.
In a professorial manner.
And I'm pointing. George, it has the expert in media.
But I also want to share the story of how we got you on this podcast, which is you collect vintage typewriters.
We got some sitting around right here.
And one of our talent bookers, Ashley, is friends with your assistant, and said, you know, Tom collects vintage typewriters, so it would be really fun to send him like a nice, we found a 1934 Smith Corona, typed out a letter on it, sent the whole typewriter over. and your response was exactly the response
you predicted.
It was exactly the response I would have wanted because it was written on the typewriter, and it started off with it was the tone of it was like, "What do you think I am, a whore? How dare you try to bribe? Oh, this thing types pretty sweet. I don't know if I, oh, and it's really silent. Oh, all right, damn you all to hell." Like, it was the most perfect.
And here I am, bought for the price of a typewriter that was in the
let
back.
Let that be
like,
known.
And then when I met you, for Biglia's movie, you were like, "You could have just asked. You didn't have to send me a typewriter."
Typewriters. I was in Germany as of my year last year, and I went to. I love history, and you know, particularly communists. Man, the communists cracked me up.
We went to
this great museum that a guy started in Dresden simply because the guy was from the West, and when the wall came down, he moved right back to Dresden to be with his family. And essentially, he couldn't get a job. So he took all this stuff and jammed it, I think, as a museum of all the stuff that's left over from East Germany. And it turns out that East Germany in the 50s had a really pretty good economy, and they made really good typewriters, which I commented on. Next thing I know, boom, it's on the radio, and I got East German typewriters arriving at the hotel, you know, like crazy. So I scored good on some, and everybody got a letter back. Dear, you know, Frau, you know,
Bosch,
thank you so much. Pardon my, I don't speak German. And the thing that's tough about German typewriters is in the German language, the Y is not used nearly as much as the letter Z. So on the typewriter keyboard, they're transposed. In American English language, QWERTY, QWERTY. In Germany, it's QWERTZ, QWERTZ. So typing a letter to somebody on a German typewriter, that's just a motherfucker. You're always part of my language.
Quartz?
You'll beep that out. Quartz, well, don't be shiz. I mean, shy. Don't, you know, you're screwing up. You're screwing up every time you try to. Thez went to the market. No,
Germans.
They went to the market.
Hard to talk about the band, yes.
You can never. Yeah. Every letter's 40 pages because he's apologizing for each mistake.
Yeah, it was a good zeer for me. Tough. But thank you for that typewriter.
No, please. It was an honor. And it was one of those things where I'm like, he's never going to respond to this. So it was a
pleasant surprise. I got a letter from a lady. Dear Mr. Hanks, I read in a magazine that you collect typewriters. My grandson is going off to college, and I thought I'd raise some money. And I've had this old typewriter in the thing, and I'd like to offer it for you. And if you'd be willing to buy it, the money would go towards my son's college education. So all right. So she left a number, and she wasn't too far away. She was up in Santa Barbara. So I called her up, cold called her. Hey, Merrill, or whatever her name was. It was Merle, something like that. Oh, well, I can't believe it, Mr. Hank. You must be calling about the typewriter.
No, actually.
I said, well.
What are you wearing?
Well, yeah, have you, you know that it's dollar pitcher night at the local Acapulco in Mexico. Let's go. So she said, well, thank you very much. I would love to buy your typewriter. How much would you like for it? She says, well, I think whatever you offer would be fair. I said, okay, well, you know, typewriters are essentially worthless, but I love them. And I bought a lot of typewriters. It's like $50 at Swap Beats and stuff like that. But I'll give you $100 for it. And she said, well, I was really hoping for
$500. Oh, so she...
Because my son's going off to college, you see. I said, $500 it is.
Oh,
what can I say? Yeah. And it was very nice. One of my nicest around here somewhere. So, hey, I'm not offering... Don't send me any.
Or if you're Daryl on Storage Wars, it'd be a $500 bill. Which he always just makes up that's, a $30 bill.
That's $500. Hey, look, here's an old typewriter. Hey, we're going to send this to that Hanks guy. That's easy. That's a C-note right there.
But then he always is like, that's a $30 bill.
I'm telling everybody on Storage Wars right now, come right to me. If you find a typewriter in one of those things, you're going to get somewhere between $50 and $100
from
me.
I will tell you this.
Cash money.
3 years from now, I'll see Barry sitting at this table with you.
Yeah, but Barry would come up with a typewriter that's made out of old, like, monkey paws. Like
guys, I think you're talking about Barrett's.
Barrett's typed on a German typewriter.
Yep, that's right. I love the idea of, like, you leave that woman's house, and then Barry calls you, like,
You did great.
Like, they totally.
I just got suckered into that one. It's probably a teenage boy sitting at home.
Oh, Mr. Hags, are you calling about the Titans?
Listen, I need you to pretend to be an old lady for a while.
I got it. Don't worry about it.
I'll split it with you.
Oh, Mr. Hags, is this how you're calling about the typewriter?
My son.
I gave some stoned 13-year-old $500 for his grandma's typewriter.
Let me get education on how to get weed.
Jeez, yeah.
Who were some of your, just really quickly, like, who were your comedy influences? I saw the Woody Allen, but then I noticed that the Woody Allen was actually,
well, the theme of this is Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
We got him, and also Willie Mays. Willie Mays, this had nothing to do with comedy, but
sure.
When I was a kid, me and my brother would see this Willie Mays, you can look it up on YouTube, it's Willie Mays, a PSA, public service announcement, for blasting caps. Now understand, we lived in Pleasant Hill, California. Willie Mays was the god of all time. Willie Mays was the most famous man on the planet, and he played in San Francisco. We saw a couple of Giants games when they came out. Actually, I saw a Giants game between, my first baseball game ever was the San Francisco Giants with Willie Mays against the Milwaukee Braves with Hank Aaron. That was a pretty great
deal.
I didn't know it at the time. It was a big deal. So I have Willie Mays up in here because he had this PSA for blasting caps that I'm going to say that my brother and I might have seen it when I was six and he was 8.5. We might have seen it 3 times, but it is so memorable. And if you get it on YouTube, it's like, these are blasting caps. Realize kids are out playing. Don't touch them. Blasting caps are dangerous. Remember now, don't touch them. Save your arms, save your legs, and save your eyes. If you see blasting caps, remember, don't touch them. So for years in our life, every time my brother's around, we say, you want some? Here, this coffee is hot. Be careful. Don't touch. We just go on and on. But I have to tell you, and it always ended, so play with these and not with those. Because it's play with these, and they show a baseball with a glove and a thing, and not with those, and they show a picture of blasting caps. I've never seen blasting caps in my life. But I guess it was a lot of like development of the 60s going on, a lot of housing developments and kid playing. And I guess, you know, you'd
it come sounds like a commercial for blasting caps.
That's it. Hi, I'm Willie Mays. Are you looking for good blasting caps?
You want to get rid of your body hair?
A baseball doesn't blow up, but blasting caps.
Remember
explode now,
don't touch them. But the way he said, so save your arms and save your legs and save your eyes. Play with these. And not with those. Oh my God! So I immediately sent it to my brother. Can we come up with stuff like that? Pull it up if you can find it, and slap that audio on.
Did
this,
you get it?
The fabulous podcast.
Here, just playing on this.
Just hold it up. Hold it up to the microphone.
But play it safe, as so is life. You can play hard, but play it safe. If you can't find anything, it looks like those. Don't chase them. Those are blasting caps. Remember, now, don't chase them. Blasting caps are used almost every place. Explosives are used, like in a construction work. But you protect your arms and hands and legs and save your eyes. If you see a blasting cap, remember now, don't touch them. Call the police or a fireman, whatever it is. Have fun, like I do, with those. And not with
these.
Fun like I did.
It's gorgeous. But after seeing that for your kids, my brother and I were convinced that we would be blown up by blasting caps if we walked anywhere where explosives are used.
Well, I am surprised. I'm surprised that "Don't Touch Them" has not found its way into a movie. That
all a good time, my friends. all a good time. Yeah, so have fun like I do. Be one of the most famous center field baseball players in the world. Oh, God bless. But comedy. I'm gonna blank on something. Robert Klein was really big, because he actually made. We grew up with comedy albums. Robert Klein's comedy album
Steve Martin was
fantastic. Well, yeah, Steve Martin. The most impactful comedy movie I'd ever seen in 100 million years was Hard Day's Night. When we went and saw Hard Day's Night, I could not believe how funny it was. Yeah. I mean, the music was of course fantastic, but those were most hilarious. You know, I'd be excited about that eventuality. I still quote it all the time.
Also, the dedication of when George Harrison just eats it on the pavement really hard.
Oh, and they all laugh.
Yeah, they all laugh.
And they all keep laughing. Oh my God! Or the way they played the card game. You know, in back in the back. You know, John Lennon's pulling aces out of his sleeve, and they made up some goofy name. Yeah. I use that stuff all the
time. Those Beatles movies. It's like they were. I love that was great, and I loved Yellow Submarine a lot.
I can't deal with Yellow Submarine.
I love
Help.
Dry.
I think Help is great.
Help is really fun.
Yeah. I saw Sergeant Pepper's recently.
The Bee Gees movie?
Oh, dear. Yeah. Wow.
which Steve Martin was in, by the way. He played Maxwell, Silver Hammers.
Yeah, Dr. Maxwell.
Oh, that's
right.
Yeah, no, I avoided that one.
Yeah, you should have.
You could just see that happening.
Ooh. George Burns is in that?
A lot of
You know what? Here's the story I remember about that, is that they had the soundtrack album to that, right? Mm-hmm. With the Bee Gees, and, you know, who were at the absolute top of the bounce.
It was 20 years ago today.
And they shipped more copies of the soundtrack to the Bee Gees
that's criminal.
Than they sold of the original Sgt. Pepper's album.
Oh, that hurts.
Wow.
That hurts.
They made more of those records than the actual Beatles Sgt. Pepper sold.
And when you think about it, it's a weird. I'm trying to equate what that would be like today. But basically, the biggest band of the 70s plays the biggest band of the 60s. Like, it's such a weird dynamic.
Not even that. It was just 10 years before.
I think they were riding high on Lucas's American Graffiti, which is a great movie that came out. I believe they made it 9 years.
But it's whatever's the biggest hit of 2002.
Wait, though, no. That would be like if the Jonas Brothers did the Nirvana movie.
No, that's 12.
You, who was big in 2002?
2002. Quick,
find out
Modest
who was
Mouse.
Really big.
Who was it?
Maybe
Madonna.
Kelly Clarkson's first album.
The Strokes were big.
The Strokes?
But not Beatles big.
Oh, man, what a hipster this is. Not The Strokes?
I worked at a record store in 2002. Oh, I know what sold.
You don't know what sold as far as...
Hey, whatever Swedish rock trios are you big on?
Just add them on.
Shakira.
Nelly.
Yeah.
All right, so that was 2002.
Sure.
So it would be like the Jonas Brothers... Playing
Nelly
from the happy, fun times of 2002.
Still after 9/11.
I'm sorry, I was trying to keep it in the rock and roll.
You were keeping it in the
rock and roll, etc.
I have to tell you, I still, when I'm driving down the street, that thing you do song, I just find myself going,
such a good song.
9 million pieces. I'm like, I haven't seen this movie in years. Like, that song.
That's because we played the song 7 times.
But
that's still not as much as like a songs in other movies. Like in So I Married an Axe Murderer, they play the There She Goes song about 8 times.
The Laws?
The Laws and the Boo Radley's.
Oh, really? Yeah. Right.
But the whole idea of that movie of writing like that one-hit wonder band with a super earwormy song, like you actually did write that super earwormy song.
I had top-notch professionals coming to me and says, you can't play that song this many times. I said, well, it's kind of the point of the movie. I know that normally we have a bunch of other things, but the fact is, I talked to the guy who was in the Hondells, who's actually a friend of Gary Gessman, my producing partner. The Hondells recorded Little Honda.
Mm-hmm.
Go faster, faster, Little Honda, Honda. A song that I think lasted 1 minute and 30 seconds. It's like incredibly fast. And he went out on the Dick Clark Rock and Roll Caravan Tour with a bunch of other bands, including the Supremes. And I said, well, what was the job? My job lasted 90 seconds every night. We'd go out, we'd play Little Honda, and then that was it. Then we were done. We'd get on the bus and go somewhere else. Jeez. So these guys, for one summer, they played Little Honda every night for, 60 nights. And then that was their gig. I thought that was just hilarious. So we played the song a lot in the movie. As would, the band that has only one hit that anybody cares.
I think That Thing You Do is probably one of the closest movies I've ever seen that like actually resemble what it's like to be in a band.
The granddaddy is This Is Spinal Tap.
Yeah,
that's the one that everybody, even musicians, will put that on. Say,
but even just the way they interact and the way they, like it shows them start, and in the director's cut, or the Tom Hanks edition, I think it's called.
Which means all the stuff that we cut out of the movie.
Yeah.
Every scene we shot is essentially what it was.
It's great. It actually made me...
It actually is a better... It's slightly... Better. It's a different... It's a more thematic movie.
And it feels... It actually... It's longer, but it feels faster. Because,
oh, that's interesting.
Know, the elements that kind of keep you excited. Like, I liked seeing Skitch's apartment to see how much of a kind of like a mod guy he was. You know, like it's like you realize because they kind of like refer to him as kind of like being a hipster type. You know?
That's all I cared about, man. That's all I cared about, man.
Like it's like seeing his apartment, and you're like,
he's got the hi-fi on. He's got Charlize Theron kissing on him. Yeah. He's watching a Kirk Douglas movie on his black and white. Oh God, I loved it so much.
It's like it perfectly sets up that guy, and then your character turns out to actually be. An old homosexual.
Yeah, my boyfriend was. I'm having a cranial plate shift here. Howie Long was my boyfriend.
That's right, yeah.
I said, Howie, listen, making this movie. I never met Howie Long. I cold called him. I know you make some movies. If you want to come and play this once, essentially what you're going to play is my boyfriend. The only thing you have to do is sit behind the wheel of an XKE Jaguar. I'll get in. We'll say a couple lines. We'll drive off laughing into the night, like every gay couple I know. Right? And he just said, hey, if you want to do it, sounds great to me.
That's awesome.
So he came and he did it, and every girl on the crew could not work that night. They all had like rubbery lines. Howie Long is on the thing because the guy is like this gorgeous guy.
The other scene that was in there that wasn't in the original theatrical release was it was a very simple scene. It was when they first get to the Pittsburgh show.
Yeah,
and then they come out on the stage to see how many people actually like how much does this fill, and then they all kind of just like are. Really blown away about they're about to play like the biggest show they've ever done, and then they kind of just start checking out the sounds like and clapping and snapping and hearing that like, and then they all just kind of start goofing off, and just that moment like it's like it the movie takes the time and it actually seems a lot more realistic of the path of the band.
You know, the frenzy that you have to cut a movie in because we wrapped that movie in I think in the spring, and we had to get it ready in time for the Toronto Film Festival. And the frenzy of cutting a movie and trying to get it all done, and it's all about the running time and stuff like that. I'm sure that I lost any sense of narrative or storytelling. Because I just go, how long is it? Yeah. It's got to be under 2 hours and 10 minutes. We just were so frustrated. But then to go back, and that's a great thing about DVDs, you could go back and put absolutely everything in that you loved in it. Because like we had the bass player...
Yes.
Actually had a romantic rendezvous with one of the Chanterelles.
That's right, yes.
You know? And it's like, then you were like, well, we thought, Gary was saying, dude, if you put that in the movie, you're going to have to go defend against a hard R. I said, are you kidding me? Well, it's a possibility that you'd have to go in and do that. You can't have anybody smoking cigarettes and stuff like that. So it was all about cutting down for time, and you end up losing all the beautiful, you know, subtle fun stuff.
Yeah, that's actually one of my favorite subtle things in the entire movie is just the bass player, also no name, just the bass player.
The bass player.
Is his name, even in the credits. But he gets better at the bass each time they play the song.
Yeah.
Every time, like, you see him, like, trying new things and getting excited, Ethan Embry.
And Ethan Embry, who plays the bass, by the way?
He
really does play the bass.
Oh, so he kind of simplified that.
I always wanted that career moment. It's just like that movie has the perfect career ascent montage of like, hey, we just heard it once on the radio, and then din and a din, then you see like climbing up the Billboard charts, and it just never works that way in real life. But it's so fucking fun.
This guy, there's a great guy, Bob Green. He's a writer. He used to be a columnist in Chicago. He wrote a great book called Be True to Your School. He was a high school journalism student and decided, as an exercise, I'm going to write a daily journal for all of the year 1964. And he did it. It's a great, from January 4th. And if you think about 1964, the Beatles were on TV in February of 1964. And by the end of 1964, A Hard Day's Night had come out. You know, so it was like, it was a fabulous year for that great British invasion. And so the idea of having a song on the charts at the Mercyhurst College talent show, and then by the end of it, you're on whatever third-rate imitation of the Ed Sullivan show that exists. You're on there, and then your band breaks up. it's actually kind of like the lifespan of an awful lot of bands as they existed at the time.
Yeah, especially Captain Keach and the Shrimp Shack Shooters.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we're gonna
location that you see in all sorts of TV commercials, by the way.
Yes, yeah.
We're going to let you go in a minute because you've been super awesome to sit here at this time with us. But two other things. First of all, I've been watching Electric City.
Oh, wow.
Really, really cool. And it looks amazing. So what, you know, like just your sort of foray into the digital space.
Yeah, which is still remains a mystery to absolutely everybody involved. The big thing is what you talk to people on the phone, you know, the people you talk to you on the phone about your career, you know. Hey, let's talk about the Electric City. Yeah, it can't be monetized. That's all they say. Well, no, it's great. It's a huge hit. Yahoo was thrilled. It had five times the clicks that Yahoo was anticipating.
You lost $1 million.
No, we lost everything. Absolutely everything. We paid salaries, which was great because we had animators and everybody that did stuff. You know, they got great animators. But then what happens after that? The only way we loved it because we just sat around here. We worked on that thing probably for about 6 years because we get these meetings every now and again. We talk about the. You know, what's the logic of the Electric City and, you know, what are the iconographic type characters? Who can we pull from history that they sort of represent, you know? And then we came up with a look and the people went berserk and we had like rooms full of, I mean, there would be a room this size and there would be, honestly, there'd be 50 animators in there all working on their laptops and doing stuff like that. So everybody got paid. And then it goes up, and I think probably like 7 million people or something like that have looked at it. And then the question is, and then? Well, unless you can get somebody interested into doing whatever the next version of media presentation is. Yeah. You know, is it a half-hour show? Is it an animated movie? Is it a feature? We don't know. But it's a great mental exercise. It's a great storytelling exercise, which was a blast. I'll never see it done. But yet it did it all for fun.
I'll tell you, I think the importance of it is you know, as we see the platforms sort of coming together, you know, there are two cables that come into people's houses right now. And sooner or later there'll be one. And I think it's very important for people in your position to, just in the same way that in the early days of cable television, which, you know, digital platform is to cable what cable was to network 20 years ago, 30 years ago, is that people go, oh, this is actually legitimate. People like Tom Hanks are getting involved. I think it's important for you guys to do that, even though there's no money in the short term, to sort of plant that long-term flag.
Well, the truth is money has nothing to do with it. And it really just is. I get to do an unvarnished, unbridled, uncensored, uncontrolled, unregulated story in which... I, as the voice of a guy named Cleveland Carr, get to do really violent things, you know, to people.
With this weird society of knitting ladies.
Yeah, under this thing of it's good for our city if you go and make these guys disappear and break their necks and do things like that. So the freedom that it gives you that you have nowhere else on the planet, that's really what it is. And I think that guys like, you know, Will Ferrell and everybody like Funny or Die or anybody else that's going off and doing it, is doing it because it's as broad a canvas and as empty a canvas as if you were a painter. You get to do anything you want to do it if you think it's fascinating and can make it interesting enough so that people will click on, you know, see the first three episodes. And by the way, the episodes are 3 minutes long. Yeah. As long as they go on the fourth and the fifth and sixth, well, then you've got them and all you're doing is being the good storyteller around the campfire. And it's a blast. And we'll do it some more. Unfortunately, even that is a little bit on the expensive side.
Yeah.
You got to be able to pay the salaries at the end of the day because you can't ask people to do this for free. It ain't right.
Just a really quick.
It ain't right.
It ain't right. I tell you. Really quickly, Cloud Atlas looks. Looks amazing.
That's gonna be wild.
I'm super excited to see that. And then if you have I'm sure you get this all the time, but we're just a lot of young performers and creators and people listening to the podcast. So, like, one piece of advice for a man in your position that people wouldn't necessarily know or hear all the time. Like, what sort of one weird, like, no one ever really told me that this is the way that a career has to happen.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. Well, I have to tell you, it's totally different now from before. When I was in, you know, in the times when I was trying to establish a beachhead or just to, like, get a job in the first place, the closest you could come to the freedom that you have now that you on the internet and the web and the is you could form a local theater group in a garage somewhere and do plays either that you liked or you made up yourself. And I know a lot of people that did. Gary Sinise, I mean, what he did with Steppenwolf Theater, he started that right out of high school. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
He started it right out of high school with Laurie Metcalf and a few, and John... No.
Cock Toastin.
No. The great Buck Howard, forgive me. I'm having a...
John Malkovich.
John Malkovich and a few others. And they did it in, like, abandoned gas stations and basements of Methodist churches. And that was it. And it was all just about, let's just do good plays and have everybody do a good part. And that became Steppenwolf Theater. that's the best example of it. But now, there is... Look, you got an idea. You've got these things, and you got that thing, and with and I'm pointing to electronic devices, a sure microphone and a camera. and an idea. That's it. The rest of it literally will take care of itself, both in ways that are amazing and ways that are ridiculous. I mean, look at the guy. There's a 32-year-old South Korean dude. You know, who's doing that goofy dance now.
Gangnam Style.
Call it what you want to do. But that dude's on Saturday Night Live now. You know, that girl that recorded that song Friday, and she's got her, like a recording record. I wish I could give salient, true advice, but the world that I came up in is gone with the wind. It doesn't exist anymore. Now the thing is that you have to do it. I think that would be the biggest
thing.
You
have to do it.
You have to do it.
And there's no excuse not to anymore.
There is... Alas, and that's what's scary. There is no excuse not to. So what you're going to be living and dying by is your own talent and your own perseverance. Mm-hmm. In the old days, you could have talent and you could have perseverance and you just had to like wait it out. You know, you had to ride it out. Now if you have talent and perseverance, you actually have to produce. Mm-hmm. You've actually got to make it happen and you've got to get it up on in whatever venue, whatever platform, is that what you said?
Yeah, yeah.
Whatever media that it is available to you, and quite frankly, if it does good, guess what? 5 million people will see it. But if you're doing something that is about truth and beauty and joy and happiness and fun or history or whatever it is, you have the tools at your disposal, and alas, now you actually have to do it yourself. And you have to do it for free, and you probably have to do it like that for a while until your output has such quality that it's recognized by anybody who sees it, and then enough people see it, and the next thing you know, someone might... give you that opportunity to come in and say, hey, why don't you develop this longer? Or we have this other thing that you might do. It happens. Here's the good news. It happens all the time now. It truly happens all the time. The lifeblood of this kooky, nutty business is new talent. And new talent actually gets to present itself on its own terms, which when I was doing Bosom Buddies was not the case. You might be able to, you could do a play somewhere, but you couldn't make a movie back
then. So you and Peter just didn't show up places and dresses and be like, this is the show!
What do you think? Funny? No, we were like offered jobs. You know, when I was doing it, you could do commercials, but you know, that was auditions that you had to pass. I couldn't get arrested in commercials. And you could do off-Broadway, you know, showcase theaters and things like that. Or you could be in a play and somebody would see you. But now you can present your own stuff and people will see it. And it will generate, you know, if it generates an audience, talent and quality will out. That's it. So it's actually a bigger burden on young artists than it used to be.
You've been amazing.
Fun talking to you.
Would you please tell our audience to enjoy their burrito? That's how we end every podcast.
Oh, is that right?
We tell them to enjoy your burrito.
Oh, man. Hey, everybody. All I can tell you is enjoy your burrito, which, by the way, is kind of like, it's a philosophy for a living.
That's what we do. That's what we say, yeah.
Enjoy your burrito, my
enjoy
friend.
The present. Enjoy the present.
Enjoy the burrito.
Don't live in the past or the future.
That's right.
Hey, Tom Hanks.
Great talking to you.
Good to see you.
Fine.
Thanks, man.
And my hat is off to the YouTube, the webmaster extraordinaire. Great.
Thank you so much.
Hey, that was fun, guys.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
That's terrific.
Lady, it was fun.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist for a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist.
I'm Shimol Yai, and I have a new podcast called The Competition. Every year, 50 high school senior girls compete in a massive scholarship competition.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
All of the competitors are used to being the best and the brightest, and they're all vying for a huge cash prize.
This will probably be the most intense thing you've ever gone through in your life.
I remember that feeling because I was one of them. I lost. But now I'm coming back as a judge and also a kind of teen girl anthropologist. Because if you want to understand what it's like to be a young woman in America today, the competition's not a bad place to start.
Hopefully no one will die on stage tonight.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.